year, whether any change needs to be made. That's the way it is in royalty, that there's an agreement, there's a reopener, a sit-down session, agreement or baseball arbitration, and prospective application of any change. This one looks like it's retroactive. And I'm already opposed to retroactivity.
Thank you. Are there further questions from the committee?
Yes.
Representative Bryce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question. Why haven't you enforced the issue and gone ahead and asked for the formal conference up front just to get the thing out of the way?
Very good question. Let me give you a hypothetical in response and see if you'll agree with me. Let's say you go to your house tonight. There's a letter from the IRS, and it says, "We just looked at your tax return, and you owe $100,000 of additional taxes beyond what you paid." You got a couple of choices. There's a phone number to call. Mm-hmm. Or, now that you've got this, you've got the right to run right to court. Mm-hmm. I think you'd pick up the phone, and you'd call and try to find out what it's about, and then you'd try to meet with an IRS agent and try to settle it out. Maybe it's just a big mistake. Mm-hmm. The system in Alaska, that maybe the commissioner will explain to you later, but it starts out with the return and the audit and the assessment. And then you're right, the taxpayer has a choice. You can go informal conference or formal conference. The formal conference is very, very much like a trial. The state hires counsels, outside counsels, and experts. The company hires outside counsels and experts. There's discovery, there are depositions that are taken, and it is that record from the formal conference that goes up to the Superior Court on appeal. You don't get a new trial on the facts. What we try to do when we get the assessment is go to informal conference and point out there's a math error. Mm-hmm. We think you misunderstood the documents that we gave you that led you to issue this portion of the assessment. Mm-hmm. We might provide, we figure out that they don't understand something, and you put the same information you've given them, you explain it to them again. And many of these issues go away at the informal conference. Mm-hmm. Having finished resolving everything that you can, and a lot of time, that's a lot of it,
Yeah. You
then focus on the issues where there's a true legal conflict between you and the state on the interpretation of the statute. That's what you take to formal conference. It makes sense. And that's what we do.
And the tribunal or the adjudicating counsel at the formal conference is?
I have a hearing officer appointed by the Commissioner of Revenue, who happens to work for the Commissioner of Revenue. And then the taxpayer and the state, the DOR's counsel, which would be the Attorney General's office, those lawyers present their cases to the hearing officer. He renders a formal conference decision. If the formal conference decision is in favor of the taxpayer, it is fixed and final, not appealable by the state. Because basically, the Department of Revenue is saying that the Department of Revenue was wrong. But the taxpayer may appeal it if it's adverse to the taxpayer. But the record from the formal conference is what is brought up to the Superior Court.
So this formal appeal process is not in accordance with the Uniform Arbitration Act or the rules of the American Arbitration Association? Okay. Further questions from the committee? Representative Porter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you agree, generally disagree, or something in between on the quid pro quo between the dollar cap on processing for gas and the definition of...
Let's look at that. Mr. Hosey made a comment. His comment was, as I recall, that this was a compromise, that the dollar a barrel, the state says that the number is more like 56 cents. The companies say it's $3 to $4. And then we have language that says that it may not exceed a dollar. Now, I read that as saying it might be 56 cents. But it can't be $3 or $4. So I don't see this compromise here. May not exceed a dollar includes 56 cents. but it doesn't include $2, $3, $4. I see absolutely no compromise and absolutely no value.
Representative Bryce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the start of your testimony, you'd had a brief discussion about the idea of the relation back theory. Could you explain again why you don't think that it's an applicable doctrine in this case?
You're asking me to give Exxon's side of the Supreme Court case that's going to be heard next Wednesday. And I will provide you with the briefs if you would like them. We have outside counsel handling that. We disagree with the state's interpretation of the relation back theory. The Superior Court disagreed with the state's relation back theory. But I think it's about the only thing that the Attorney General has to argue before the Supreme Court. Mr. Hosey said they are very confident about their position. I would submit that it would be very appropriate for you to allow them to bring their position before the court. If you pass this bill, that will not happen, because this bill takes away all of my rights to be heard in the Supreme Court. I have no rights once you pass Section 16 and 17, declaring that Section 1, not declaring, that's not the right, stating that Section 1 is declaratory of what the law was, and Section 17 saying that it is applicable to cases pending before the courts. I'm out of there. Attorney General will go up and hand them SB 377 and say that there is nothing for you to decide. And that is not right.
That's all, Representative Porter?
Yes, thank you.
Representative Ulmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, on that point, you said earlier that, you know, the day in court controversy, it's kind of an interesting way to frame the question. I mean, you're saying that you're being deprived of your day in court by this legislation because it in essence says that the state may continue to have its day in court on the merits of the assessments and the collection issues. So one's a process point, the other is a substance point. And I think it's something we ought to clarify for the committee. If the statute is not adopted, a timing question, a process issue, precludes the state from having its day in court in terms of the merits or the substance or the validity of the assessments. And your day in court is limited strictly to an interpretation of a procedural limit on the ability to actually get at the merits of the case. So they're not exactly equal, and I think that's what we're trying to struggle with here as we strike a fair balance between the industry and the state. You know, I don't think anyone sitting around this table likes the idea of retroactivity, although I think in fairness to you, you should know that this legislature has already adopted a statute this session that retroactively precludes private nuisance lawsuits, for example. I mean, we're quite willing to do that, unfortunately. But I think the question here is a procedural point. We're not changing the rules, so to speak, in terms of what taxes are owed. We're changing the rules just in terms of how much time you get to debate over what the taxes are owed. So I don't know. I'd appreciate your comment on that, but you can't blame the state for trying to bring some certainty and guarantee that it will have an opportunity in court to collect the taxes.
Mr. Chairman, let me give 3 points in response to that. The first is, if I'm not incorrect, private nuisance lawsuit issue, the Attorney General came before a committee reviewing that bill and argued that because of the retroactivity, it was not the correct thing to do because it was probably unconstitutional. I think I'm right. We may have to check. Second, I will agree that a procedural change within the year is just that. But a change which goes retroactive 18 years is the equivalent of changing the underlying law, because 18 years after the fact, many of the people who worked on issues that might be raised tomorrow if you pass this bill today are no longer with Exxon Corporation. Many have retired. Some may have passed away. Records on issues that I haven't got the foggiest idea what they might be have been moved several times in relocations and et cetera. So it's not procedural. It is going to the heart of the matter. Those are the points I'd like to make.
It may go to the heart of the matter in the sense of the evidence and the ability, the freshness of the material that needs to be presented in deciding it. Exactly. But it doesn't go to the question of whether or not a fundamental right to sue, a cause of action, is being altered. And I guess that's the distinction, isn't it, between the private nuisance example and this example? It goes to the question of whether or not the right that an individual has to sue, based on the merits of that case versus the right simply on the timeliness or the freshness or the staleness of the evidence.
There is a fundamental right which is being abrogated by this legislation. And that is the right to rely on the laws. The law is what the law is, and the Superior Court has stated what the law meant. And we had a right to rely on that law. And passing this legislation, if it were done today, I might get another assessment tomorrow. I did get assessments that came 8 or 10 years after the year to which they related. I was in trouble to begin with on those because of the books and records and corporate memory and people who had retired and didn't remember the transaction, and it was not fresh, it was stale. That's why you have statute of limitations, so that I know where there may be differences of opinion between Exxon Corporation and any state or federal or foreign government, and I can gather the records while they are still fresh, I can gather the people while they are still fresh, and I can defend myself. This doesn't allow me to do that.
But if
this type of legislation does not allow me to do that.
Back to Representative Bryce's point, though, if that was a real concern to Exxon, it seems to me that you would have gone to the formal hearing process, the formal adjudication, to bring closure when you had a higher degree of certainty about what the evidence would be. And I'm not sure whether in your response you were suggesting that you don't feel as though there's due process associated with a hearing officer procedure in the Department of Revenue. I don't know whether you're suggesting that or not.
There are some concerns in that area. They're unrelated to this bill and what's before us today. We received a total of, if I remember correctly, 8 assessments with respect to our 1978 year. We started out with timely assessments where we would analyze them, protest them, analyze, then get another one, analyze it, protest it, analyze, protest. And then we got ones that were untimely, where we analyzed and protested and included in the protest that this was not a valid assessment because the statute of limitations had run. In the process, the administrative process within the Department of Revenue, we agreed to accelerate the question on the statute of limitations by what's called bifurcating the case. There was timely assessments issued with respect to ROI that you've heard about and ANS crude value. We said, okay, we're going to put these over here and work them, but we're going to accelerate this question on the statute of limitations because it is at the heart of getting the year closed. So that was taken through informal and formal on an accelerated basis. We did try to accelerate the issue. That still meant we didn't get an answer out of the formal conference until May of 1989. We immediately went to the Superior Court. It was about a 2-year period before a decision in 1990, I think it was 1992.
And then
the state appealed.
Were due process issues raised in that litigation?
I believe they may have been.
Okay. Because I knew in some proceeding, I wasn't sure whether it was yours, that the due process claim had been raised and that the court had ruled that there were no violations of due process in the hearing officer procedure, and that, as a matter of fact, a number of them had been decided against the state, which reinforced the state's determination, the court's determination, that there wasn't a due process problem. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Davies?
Thank you. The Attorney General also indicated a third method, or second method, I guess, for stopping the clock, which was to pay the assessment and then file a claim for a refund. Could you comment on your view of that process?
The assessments were anywhere near the taxpayers' internal analysis of the ultimate liability, that would probably occur. However, where they are significantly inflated, I don't know about other corporations, but we don't have the money to put on deposit with a lot of states awaiting the process to get it back. I'll give you an example in the federal arena. Exxon was presented with an assessment from the federal government that incorporated an issue involving the value of Saudi crude. Many of you may have heard of the Saudi pricing case. In any event, the assessment was multiple billions of dollars. We chose, in that instance, to go to the tax court. The interest you can get to the tax court is all you do is file a petition. If you want to go to the court of claims, you have to pay the tax and sue for a refund. You have an alternative system of going to the tax court. We went to the tax court because we did not owe those dollars, and they were so substantial that we weren't going to pay them. We had a recent decision in our favor on the Saudi pricing case. That was a multi-billion dollar case. In the state arena, same thing. If the tax is somewhere near the liability, then you'll seriously look at the option of paying and going for refunds, where there are huge differences between your analysis of ultimate liability and assessment. It's going to be
follow up on that specific point. When a company in its financial books claims that it has sufficient reserves to meet its potential liabilities in these court cases, when you make those statements, do you take into account your assessment of the risk of you losing those assessments?
Many, many companies do them many, many different ways. A lot of companies have been around for a long time. You might just have a built-up statistical average of what's happened over time, and that's the more reserves are done. I can't speak for industry or business in general.
So I guess what you're saying, though, I mean, you said that there's a cash flow problem with doing that, so it must mean that there isn't actually a bank account somewhere that has the amount in it that would be equal to the total liability that you might be exposed to. So is that correct?
That is a correct statement. There is not.
Thank you. And then the last question I had has to do with Section 18, and I wondered if, apart from the fact that there's a Section 1 in this bill, could you comment on Section 18?
That's the NGLs. And as I think I told you,
the effective date.
And we had prior testimony from the Attorney General that said that the state's position on NGLs is, quote, unique, unquote. Every other state treats them as gas. So whatever effective date you want. All this does is it gives certainty. I will agree with that. It gives certainty. It certainly says that the state of Alaska is no longer unique. It's like the rest of the states. It's treating natural gas liquids as gas. But if that's a compromise, the only thing it's doing is removing litigation wherein we would show that natural gas liquids are gas.
Thank you. Representative Norland?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sullivan, you mentioned that there are, or admitted basically that there are certain sections of this bill that would help lead to lessen the amount of litigation in the future, but that you said that Section 1 was going to lead to additional litigation.
I suspect.
And I know at least one case that you won't need to litigate if that section passes. But what further litigation are you talking about? I didn't follow that.
Well, I suspect that serious consideration would be given by one or more companies to challenge the constitutionality of SB 377 if passed. Section 1 to the constitutionality of a retroactive change in the law for 18 years.
Representative Hudson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
There may also, excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Please continue.
There may be litigation in terms of a particular 78 case as to whether we have a property right in a decision of the Superior Court in support of a constitutional. There'd be a lot of things.
Representative Hudson?
Thank you. Mr. Sullivan, in layman's language, what is, as simply stated, the principal question before the court. You've indicated that if this bill passes, it takes away your rights to proceed in the courts. Maybe you could just help me at any rate if you could tell me, what is that question?
The question before the court is essentially, did the Superior Court, is the decision of the Superior Court correct? And the decision of the Superior Court was that this statute, the assessment statute, was plain and unambiguous on its face and not subject to any other interpretation, that it specifically, the statute and the regs, had three enumerated exceptions: fraud, failure to file, or a joint agreement between the taxpayer and the Department of Revenue to extend the statute. And that under those circumstances, 3 years means what it means. That there is 3 years from the date the return is filed for the Department of Revenue to audit and issue assessment, and that any assessment that came after that period is invalid. So it's an appeal by the Attorney General from a decision which he disagrees with to see if the Supreme Court will agree with him.
Thank you.
Mr. Sullivan, do you have an idea of how many, what the total number of assessments that the state of Alaska has against Exxon right now in terms of oil property tax or severance tax?
The number of outstanding assessments?
Yes.
We have received assessments for the 78 to 81 income tax, the closed through 78 production, assessments for 79 through 89, and for the modified apportionment income tax, 82 through 87. But that does not mean that there is one assessment per year. I use the example of 1978, wherein we received eight separate assessments with respect to that one income tax year. Four or five of those were timely, and three or four, and I can't remember, were after the statute had run, according to Exxon and according to the Superior Court. Now, to go back again and make the point, there are two Superior Court decisions. One of them is on the six-year collection statute, and it holds that the state's interpretation that the statute stops for the period of the administrative appeals until there's a final determination of liability. But the state is right. There's another one that says that 3 years means what it says, and you can assess within the 3 years or any extension thereof mutually agreed in writing. And after that, any subsequent assessment is untimely. Both of the statutes that you're being asked to be change have been to the court, and decisions have been rendered. And based on the Attorney General's split that two-thirds of the dollars are in the collection statute and one-third is in the assessment statute, I guess another way of looking at it is state won two-thirds and the taxpayer won one-third.
Right? Elmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one last question. When you first began, you mentioned that this provision may not be different from other states, but what is different is that in other states, the legislature did not go back later and declare it to be the law. That is the way it's been in other states, and there just wasn't an issue about how it was to be applied. Now, in this case, the industry is representing this as retroactively changing the rules of the game. The state is representing it as, in essence, blessing past practices, basically a statement on the part of the legislature that the legislation means what the state says it means, as opposed to what the industry says it means. The state is basically, the Attorney General has come to us and said, this is what we think it means. You have indicated that if this was a longstanding policy, there is some evidence of the record why it was not a longstanding policy. In terms of the Department of Revenue saying that they haven't made up their mind what their official policy is, but that's different than saying that that's what the Attorney General's ruling is, that that's what the law has always been in Alaska, until the Superior Court came along and said that isn't what the three-year assessment statute means. Superior Court all of a sudden says it means something else. Attorney General says the Superior Court is wrong. It's always meant this, not that. And they're going to court, you're going to court, to get the Supreme Court to say it means what the Attorney General says. It doesn't mean what the Superior Court judge said it means. That's where we really are. And I guess what's very confusing to legislators when it is, when the framing of the issue is retroactively changing the rules of the game, it suggests somehow that the tax laws are being changed, which of course they're not.
Representative Elmer, could you please lead into a question somewhere?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying. I am trying, honestly. The framing of the issue as retroactively changing the rules of the tax law, that's what I'd like you to speak to at this point, if you would, because I see it as declaration of the law in a way that you do not like and the Attorney General does like. How is that consistent with your describing it as changing the rules by which the taxes are calculated in the state of Alaska?
Well, let's take an example. I got my first assessment on 78, and in that assessment it says this assessment may change within a period of 3 years from the date of this assessment. Let's suppose that 3 years and one day later, now knowing the issues in the assessment for which I have to keep corporate records because they're in the assessment and these are issues that are going to be talked about, I throw everything else away. Now, in 1984, lo and behold, there's an Attorney General's opinion that says, with the showing of good cause, assessment may be changed, but the Department of Revenue must show the reasons why they didn't originally put it in the in an earlier assessment. Now I'm out in the garbage can and I'm trying to find those records. Then I get a letter in 1980. Well, then I see Standard says, the Department of Revenue says in the Standard case that we have no position. Now I'm looking for all the government records. And I get a letter from the Department of Revenue that says, we want you and others to file friends of the court briefs. And that letter, by the way, went to 30 or more companies. Remember the first thing I did in my hypothetical? I threw out the records because I had an indication from the Department of Revenue what the rule was. I didn't even agree with that rule that said 3 years from the date of the assessment because I read the law and it said 3 years from the date the return was filed. That's the difference. Now, you go a year back, and you can, it's okay, as far as I'm concerned, to differentiate between, for example, changing the tax rate in 1978 from whatever it was then to something higher. We all agree that is a problem. If you change an administrative procedure surrounding a law back to the first of the year, maybe back to the year before, it's not going to be too big a problem. But when you go back 18 years, I have difficulty differentiating between the heart of the law and the rules around the law. Boom, they are the same because you're going back so far. Each affects the other, and they're indistinguishable. That's my position.
Representative John Davies.
Thank you. On that point, it seems to me that in every one of these cases, the state has filed an assessment within the three-year period. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
So, and in the case that you're talking about of, say, 3 years and one day after that assessment was filed, you throw away your records. But aren't, at that point in time, aren't you still in dispute with the state?
On an identified portfolio of issues, those included in the assessment that I received.
But, I mean, you're still in dispute on those back taxes.
On the issues in the assessment that I have received, that is correct.
But I guess I'm having trouble understanding why, if there's still a dispute going on, why you would throw any records away.
Because I've narrowed down the area of dispute between the state or federal government or whatever and myself. I know what records I have to keep because I have been told what issues exist when they gave me the assessment. By giving me the assessment, they also told me what issues didn't exist. And those are the ones that weren't in the assessment. But lo and behold, 10 years later, the issues that didn't exist pop up in an assessment which I say is untimely.
I guess if the IRS sent me an audit of my 1985 tax records, I wouldn't throw anything away that said 1985 on it.
But they didn't say they were going to audit your 85. The IRS sent you a notice saying, in your 1985 return, we want you to provide additional information with respect to interest deductions. You provide information, and then you get an assessment, and then the federal statute runs, and you throw out all of your documentation on charitable contributions. Because you know the issue that you have with the IRS is on interest expense deductions. And now, 5 years later, they come back and issue you another assessment and ask about your charitable contributions, and you say, wait a minute, I threw all my records out. That's what we're talking about, between known and unknown.
How long does Exxon usually keep these kind of records around? Is there a general rule of thumb, or is it just whatever?
There is a records retention procedures, and I'm using a hypothetical here in terms of just trying to show how 18 years retroactive is impacted by many, many things. It's impacted by records, it's impacted by corporate memory, meaning the people who were there when the transaction was done. Even sometimes you can find the people and they go, yeah, I remember that vaguely.
Yeah, I understand.
Now, if I had an assessment in 3 years, they'd say, I remember that.
But there isn't any general policy about how long you keep stuff, is it? Just depends on what kind of a document it is.
Don't throw things out before statute of limitations runs.
Or agreement sticks in them.
Probably you don't throw things out before statute of limitations that has been looked at by a court runs.
Mr. Sullivan, on that point, I mean, would you just kind of, could you give us an idea of the volume of records that Exxon Corporation stores, or how many square feet of warehouse that you store your records?
I wouldn't have the foggiest idea.
We're talking entire warehouse fulls.
A lot, and that's about as close as I could come.
I'm sorry, Representative Davison, I believe, was indicated.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sullivan, you've given us a very tightly crafted statement here, it seems, and it was a little too fast for slow person like me, but it seems you have indicated that let me pass for a moment, Mr. Chairman. Well, let me ask you this. Given the limitations factor, is it not in your interest to grant all of the request by the state to extend your dispute?
Mr. Chairman, I indicated earlier that on every occasion that Exxon has been requested by the state to grant an extension, we have done so. Now, let me mention there's one where it didn't work. The year in 1993, the Department of Revenue, mid-December, the statute of limitations for the production tax years 87, 88, and 89 are going to expire at year-end 93. I got a call, I think, it was in December, and was advised by the state, or Exxon got a call, I don't think I got it directly, that they needed a little more time to properly complete transportation portion of the assessment. And they asked if Exxon would extend the statute of limitations another time. We already extended it once or twice before. And when the fellow in my department who got the call asked me, I said, well, if the problem that the division has is with respect to the transportation portion of the assessment, then I will agree to give them an extension limited to the transportation portion of the assessment that I'm going to receive. Now, they said that's where their problem was. I do want to speed up the process. They told me everything else was ready. I said, then I'll give you a limited extension for the area that you tell me you need it for. They said no and issued the assessment on December 31st. So I guess that's the only time I played hardball with them, which was simply saying I'll extend for the reason you told me you need the extension. Every other time it's just been a blanket extension.
Mr. Chairman, I have just one other question, if I may. You've characterized this piece of legislation as something that you just cannot live with. But it's my understanding that it was your company that was involved in crafting a negotiated resolve to go forward with this legislation. That is not so? Is that?
That is not so. I believe I came up here a week ago Wednesday, when I was advised that there was going to be a meeting between industry and Department of Revenue and Department of Law to work on a potential bill on some of these issues that are outside of Section 1. And I came here to do that. And the landscape quickly changed. Saw these bills, and I've been consistent in my opposition to this since then.
So if this bill goes forward, did I understand you correctly to say that you still have to go forward with the case before the Supreme Court, right?
No. If this bill is passed, what the legislature has done is pull the rug out from any opportunity for me to have my day in court. Because Section 16 in this bill says that it is declaratory of existing law as originally enacted, and Section 17 says that it applies to an action or appeal pending before a court on the effective date. The import of those two sections, this bill passes, is to take away my right, my day in court, to defend the Superior Court decision that was rendered in my favor. Because the law that is before the court is the 3-year statute, and this changes that statute. So I have nothing to argue, because the legislature will have taken away what I am in the Supreme Court attempting to finalize, and something that we have been consistent in our interpretation of the statute from the very first assessment that came 3 years after our return was filed. And we've been consistent in that position for over 10 years. And we are now 6 months, well, we're 5 days from an oral argument and probably 4 to 8 months from a decision, this legislative body may take the opportunity for a final resolution of that question. That's what happens when we pass this bill.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Hudson.
Just one more. Mr. Sullivan, if the court case that's in process right now proceeded as scheduled and the lower court's position is upheld, does the state risk the loss of all assessments made within the 3-year limit, or are only the increased assessments that were introduced after the 3-year limit at risk?
I can only speak to Exxon's case, and I will remind you that on average, the state has had 5 or 6 years for each tax period to audit Exxon, because we have entered into a voluntary written agreement with the state to extend the statute. I assure you, any assessment that was issued during the first 3 years or any extension to the 3 years that Exxon has received is not at risk at all. Those are valid assessments. I also am telling you that in Exxon's opinion, the Superior Court decision in the Tesoro case on the 6-year collection statute is the law and says that the $2 billion that the Attorney General told you is quote, at risk under the assessment statute is not at risk. Because there is a court decision that says the Attorney General is correct.
So then,
it's taxpayer to taxpayer on what the valid assessments are. I've got years where the valid assessment came 8 years after I filed the return, and that's because I agreed with the Department of Revenue to extend.
Without figures, Mr. Sullivan, what percentage of the total difference between the state's claim and the company's view is protected within the 3 years or the agreed-upon extensions? What percentage is outside of that? Just a percentage, roughly speaking.
You're talking excellent specific?
Yes, sir.
I'm not going to be specific simply because of the audience, but I will tell you that as a percentage of the total assessment, it's not that much.
The percentage that is within the fair game.
Oh, the fair game portion. Sorry, I'm answering your question now.
Yeah. All right, yeah.
The percentage of timely assessments is very large.
So then at risk is the smaller of the percentages.
That's right. I'm sorry, I confused you.
Yeah.
Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, we'll stand adjourned until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.